but only for a couple of years. He's out now.
Where was he? The Joy.
Exciting. Did you visit?
Not often, no. It's no place for a child, or at least that's what he always said. I was there myself once, he said, when I was a boy. My father was representing a man who murdered his wife. The place smelled of toilets, I said.
I remember. You told me before.
Did I?
Yes.
And you remembered?
Even all these years later.
Well, I said, feeling my face begin to redden slightly, not wanting my fascination with him to reveal itself too quickly. I have been there myself since, as I said, and I thought the same thing.
Great minds and all that.
So what happened when he got out? Did he leave the country?
No. The bank took him back.
Really? He said, bursting out laughing.
Yes. Actually, he's doing very well again. But they changed his job title. He used to be Director of Investments and Client Portfolios.
And what is he now?
Director of Client Investments and Portfolios.
Forgiving sort, aren't they?
Still, a spell in prison is probably a badge of honour for people in that field.
I looked down at his feet and noticed that he was wearing runners, a fashion statement that was new to Ireland at the time. My father brought them back from London, he said, following the direction of my eyes. They're my second pair, actually. I had them in the 6, but my feet grew. I'm an 8 now.
Don't let the priests see them, I said. They say runners are only worn by Protestants and socialists. They'll confiscate them.
They'd have a hard job, he said.
But all the same, he used the tip of his right foot to kick the left shoe off at the heel before using his stocking toes to remove the right and kick the pair under his bed.
Not a snorer, are you?
Not that I know of, I said.
Good. I am, I'm told. Hope I don't keep you awake.
I don't mind. I'm a heavy sleeper.
I probably won't hear you.
You might.
My sister says that when I get started, I'm like a foghorn.
I smiled. Already, I longed for bedtime. I wondered whether he was one of those boys who went to a toilet cubicle to change, or whether he would simply strip off in the room. I suspected the latter. I doubted he had any self-consciousness at all.
What's it like here, anyway? He asked. Is there any fun to be had?
It's all right, I said. The boys are fine. The priests are vicious, of course, but, well, that's to be expected.
Have you ever met a priest who didn't want to beat 6 shades of shit out of you?
They get off on it, of course. My eyes and mouth opened wide in scandalized delight.
No, I admitted. Not so far, anyway. I think it's something they teach them in the seminary.
It's because they're also sexually frustrated, of course, he told me.
They can't have sex, you see. So they beat up little boys and it gives them stiffies when they do it. It's the closest they get to orgasms during the day.
It's ridiculous, really. I mean, I'm sexually frustrated, but I don't think beating up children will solve the problem.
What would? I asked.
Well, fucking, of course. He said, as if it was the most natural thing in the world.
Right, I said. Haven't you ever noticed, though? The next time one of the priests hits you, take a look downwards and you'll see that he's flying at full mast. And afterwards they go back to their rooms and wank themselves silly thinking about us.
Do they come into the shower rooms here?
Well, yes, I said, to make sure that everyone is washing themselves correctly.
Bless your pure heart, he said, looking at me as if I was an innocent child. It's not our personal hygiene that they're interested in, Cyril.
In my last school, there was a priest named Father Cremens who tried to kiss me and I punched him in the nose. It broke. There was blood everywhere. But of course there was nothing he could do about it because he could hardly report me in case I said what had provoked the attack. He told everyone that he walked into a door instead.
Boys kissing boys, I said, laughing nervously and scratching my head. I didn't know that. I mean, it seems strange that, after all, when there are...
Are you all right, Cyril? He asked. Your face has gone all red and you're waffling.
I think I'm getting a cold, I said, my voice choosing that exact moment to slip between registers. I think I'm getting a cold, I repeated,
adopting my deepest tone now. "Well, don't give it to me," he said, turning away to place his toothbrush and face cloth on his bedside table along with a copy of Howard's End. "I can't stand being ill."
"Where were you before here, anyway?"
I asked after a lengthy pause, when it seemed as if he'd forgotten that I was even in the room.
"Blackrock College."
"I thought your father was a Belvedere boy."
"He is," he replied. "But he's one of those past pupils who likes to revel in memories of his glory days on the rugby field, but probably remembers enough bad things about the place to make him send his own son somewhere else. He took me out of Blackrock when he found out that my Irish language teacher had written a poem and published it in the Irish Times, casting doubt on the virtue of Princess Margaret. He won't hear a word said against the royal family, you see. Although they do say that Princess Margaret is a bit of a slut. Apparently she puts it to bed with half the men in London, and some of the women, too. I wouldn't say no, though. Would you? She's a looker. A lot more fun than the Queen, I imagine. Can you imagine the Queen going down in Prince Philip's cock? That's the kind of image that would give you nightmares.
I remember your father, I told him, startled by the frankness of his conversation and wishing to steer it back to safer territory. He interrupted a dinner party in my house once and had a fight with my adoptive father.
Did your old man fight back?
He did. It didn't do him any good. He took a pasting.
Well, old Max was a prize fighter when he was younger, said Julian proudly. He's still pretty handy with his fists, actually, he added. I should know.
Do you remember meeting me back then? I asked.
There's a tiny bell ringing somewhere in my head, said Julian. Maybe I remember you slightly.
My room was the one on the top floor of the house.
My sister Alice uses that room now. I never go up there. It reeks of perfume.
Well, what about you? I asked, feeling a little sad that he didn't use my old room. I rather liked the idea of us having that in common. Where do you sleep?
A room on the second floor.
Why, does it matter?
Is it the room overlooking the square or the garden at the rear of the house?
The square. That was my adoptive mother's study. Charles had the first floor and Maud had the second.
Of course, he said, brightening up now. Your mother was Maud Avery, wasn't she?
That's right, I said.
Well, my adoptive mother.
Why do you keep saying that?
It's the way I was brought up, I told him. I'm not a real Avery, you see.
What an odd thing to say.
My adoptive father insists that I make it clear to people.
So I'm sleeping in the room where Maud Avery wrote all her books?
If you've the room that overlooks the square, then yes.
Gosh,
he said, impressed.
Now that is something. A real claim to fame, wouldn't you say?
Is it?
I asked.
Of course it is. It was Maud Avery's writing room. The Maud Avery. Your father must be rolling in it now, he added. Wasn't there a point last year where she had 6 books in the top 10 bestsellers chart at the same time? I read that it was the first time this had ever happened.
I think it was 7, actually, I said. But yes, I suppose he is. He makes more money from her work than he does from his own.
And how many languages is she translated into now?
I don't know, I said. A lot. It seems to grow all the time.
It's a pity she died before she knew real success, said Julian. She would have been gratified to know how respected she's become.
There are so many writers who have to wait until they're dead to be fully appreciated. You know, Van Gogh only sold 1 painting during his lifetime, and that Herman Melville was an absolute unknown while he was alive, was only discovered, so to speak, when he was already in the ground. He was worm food before anyone even took a second glance at Moby Dick.
He idolized Hawthorne, of course, and was always popping over there for his tea, but who can name one of Hawthorne's novels now?
The Scarlet Letter, I said.
Oh, yes. The one about the girl who puts it to bed while her husband's at sea. I haven't read it. Is it dirty? I love dirty books.
Have you read Lady Chatterley's Lover?
My father got a copy in England, and I snuck it out of his library to read it. It's pure filth. There's a wonderful bit where...
I don't think fame was what Maud was looking for, I said, interrupting him. Actually, I think the idea of literary approbation would have appalled her.
Why? What's the point of writing if no one reads you?
Well, if the work has some value, then there's merit in that alone, surely. Don't be ridiculous. It's like having a wonderful voice, but only singing to an audience of deaf people.
I don't think that's the way she viewed art, I said.
Popularity didn't interest her. She'd no desire for her novels to be read. She loved language, you see. She loved words. I think she only felt truly happy when she was staring at a paragraph for hours at a time and trying to refine it into a thing of beauty. She only published her books because she didn't like the idea of all that hard work going to waste.
What a lot of old nonsense, he said,
dismissing what I had said as if it was scarcely worth his consideration.
If I was a writer, I'd want people to read my books, and if they didn't, I would feel that I'd failed.
I'm not sure that I would agree, I said,
surprised to find myself contradicting him, but I wanted to defend Maud's beliefs.
To be honest, I think there's more to literature than that.
Have you read any of them? He asked me. Your mother's novels, I mean.
My adoptive mother, I said.
And no, I haven't. Not yet.
None of them?
No.
He laughed and shook his head.
But that's appalling. She was your mother, after all.
My adoptive mother?
Stop saying that.
You should try Like to the Lark. It's wonderful.
Or The Codicil of Agnes Fontaine. There's an extraordinary scene in that book where two girls bathe together in a lake and they're totally naked and so much sexual tension between them that I guarantee you won't get to the end of the chapter without pulling Percy out for an old five-finger shuffle. I adore lesbians, don't you? If I were a woman, I would absolutely be a lesbian. London is full of lesbians, or so I hear. And New York? When I'm older, I'm going to go over there, become friends with a few of them, and ask, can I watch them when they're doing it?
What do you suppose they do, exactly?
I've never been quite sure.
I stared at him and felt myself growing a little unsteady on my feet. I had no answer to any of this, and, truth be told, I wasn't entirely sure that I knew what a lesbian was. As excited as I had been about Julian's arrival at Belvedere, I began to think that perhaps we were operating on completely different levels of consciousness. The last book I had read was A Secret Seven.
Do you miss her?
He asked me, closing his emptied suitcase now and pushing it under the bed next to his runners.
What's that?
I asked, my mind on other things.
Your mother.
Your adoptive mother.
Do you miss her?
A little, I suppose, I admitted. We weren't very close, to be honest, and she died only a few weeks before Charles got out of prison, which was almost 5 years ago now. I don't think about her very much anymore.
And what about your real mother?
I don't know anything about her, I said.
Charles and Maud said they had no idea who she was. They got me from a little hunchbacked Redemptorist nun when I was only a few days old.
What killed her?
Maud, I mean.
Cancer, I said. She had it a few years before in her ear canal, but then it started again in her throat and tongue. She smoked like a chimney. I almost never saw her without a cigarette in her hand.
Well, that might do it. Do you smoke, Cyril?
No.
I don't like the idea of smoking.
Have you ever kissed a girl who smoked?
I opened my mouth to reply, but language escaped me, and to my horror I could feel the blood rushing towards my penis in response to such candid conversation. I let my hands drop before my crotch, hoping that Julian wouldn't be as conscious of my excitement as he was of the priests who had beaten him in Black Rock.
No,
I said.
It's awful, he said, pulling a disgusted face. You don't get the taste of the girl at all, just that foul nicotine.
He paused for a moment and stared at me, half amused.
You have kissed a girl, though, haven't you?
Of course,
I said, laughing with the insouciance of one who's been asked whether he has ever seen the ocean or travelled on an aeroplane.
Dozens of them.
Dozens? He said, frowning. Well, that's a lot. I've only kissed three so far.
But one of them let me put my hand down her brassiere to touch her breast.
Dozens, you say?
Really?
Well,
maybe not dozens, I said, looking away.
You haven't kissed anyone at all, have you? I have, I said. No, you haven't. But that's all right. We're only 14, after all. It's all in front of us. I intend to live a long and healthy life and fuck as many girls as I can. I'd like to die in my bed, age 105, with a 22-year-old bouncing up and down on top of me. And what are the chances of kissing anyone here, anyway? It's all boys. I'd rather kiss my granny, and she's been dead for 9 years. But look, do you want to help me unload my books? They're in that box over there. Can I mix them in with yours, or would you rather I put them on a separate shelf? Let's mix them in together, I said. All right. He stood back and looked me up and down again, and I wondered whether perhaps another button had come undone. Do you know, I think I do remember you now, he said. Didn't you ask me whether you could see my thing? No, I said, appalled by the accusation, which, after all, was entirely false, considering it was him who had asked to see mine. No, I didn't.
Are you sure?
Quite sure, I said. Why would I want to see your thing? I have one of my own, after all. I can see it whenever I want.
Well, there was definitely a boy who asked me around that time. I'm sure it was you. I remember the room, and it's Alice's room now.
You couldn't be more wrong, I insisted. I have absolutely no interest in your thing and never have had.
If you say so. It's a very nice thing, anyway. Can't wait to start using it in the way that God intended, can you? You've gone quite red, Cyril, he added. Not frightened of girls, are you?
No, I said. Not at all.
If anything, they should be frightened of me. Because I want to, you know, have lots of sex with them and stuff.
Good.
Because I suppose we'll have to be friends, you and I, since we're sharing a room.
We'll go on the hunt together sometimes.
You're not a bad-looking fella, after all. There might be a few girls who could be persuaded to let you do it with them. And of course, they're all crazy about me.
The TD from Dublin Central.
The teachers were crazy about him too and awarded him the gold medal for most improved pupil at the Easter prize-giving ceremony, which was greeted with derision by those students who did not hold Julian in the same high esteem as I did. Since he hadn't even been enrolled at Belvedere College during the previous term, it was a mystery to them how he had managed to improve at all, and the rumour went around that Max had granted a bursary to the school on the condition that his son's resume would be padded with glory over the coming years. I was delighted, of course, for it meant that, as part of his reward, he would be joining me and four others, the gold medal winners in English, Irish, mathematics, history and art, on a trip to Dáil Éireann to witness the workings of the Irish Parliament. I had won the English prize for an essay I'd written entitled Seven Ways to Better Myself, in which I listed various qualities that I knew would impress the priests, but that I had absolutely no intention of pursuing in real life, except for the last one, whose addendum wasn't a problem to me at all. They were, in order of appearance. 1. Study the life of St. Francis Xavier and recognize aspects of his Christian behavior that I could emulate. 2. Identify those boys in my class who were struggling at subjects in which I excelled and offer to help them. 3. Learn a musical instrument, preferably the piano, but definitely not the guitar. 4. Read the novels of Walter Machen. 5. Begin a novena dedicated to the repose of the soul of the late Pope Pius XII. 6. Find a Protestant and make him see the errors of his ways. 7. Banish all impure thoughts from my mind, particularly those that focused on the intimate parts of people of the opposite gender. It wasn't the gold medal that I craved so much as the day out, the destination of which changed every year and had previously included such exhilarating venues as Dublin Zoo, Hothead and Dunleary Pier. This year, however, things had taken a more exciting turn with the announcement of a visit to the city centre, a place that, despite its proximity to our school, was out of bounds to us at all times with no exceptions according to the student handbook. As boarders, we could leave Belvedere on weekends as long as we were in the custody of a parent, a guardian, or a priest, none of which particularly appealed to us. However, It was absolutely forbidden to spend any time in O'Connell Street or Henry Street, which, we were told, were havens for vice and iniquity, or Grafton Street and its environs, which were the domain of writers, artists, and other deviants. "I know the city centre quite well," Julian told me on the short bus journey from Parnell Square to Kildare Street. "My father brings me and Alice there for lunch occasionally, but he always refuses to take me to the places that I really want to go."
"Which ones are they?" I asked.
"Harcourt Street," he replied knowingly. "That's where all the girls hang out. And the nightclubs on Leeson Street. But of course, they're not open till night time.
I hear that the women there will do it with anyone if you buy them a snowball."
I said nothing and looked out the window at the posters advertising Ben-Hur that hung from the front of the Savoy Cinema. As infatuated as I was with Julian, I found his tendency to talk constantly about girls frustrating. It was an obsession for him, as much as it is for most 14-year-old boys, I suppose, but he seemed excessively preoccupied with sex and wasn't shy about telling me all the things that he would do to any girl who would let him have his way with her, fantasies that both aroused and distressed me with the certain knowledge that he would never want to do any of those things with me. Did I spend much time examining my feelings for Julian in those days? Probably not. If anything, I deliberately avoided analysing them. It was 1959, after all. I knew almost nothing of homosexuality except for the fact that to act on such urges was a criminal act in Ireland that could result in a jail sentence. Unless, of course, you were a priest, in which case it was a perk of the job. I had a crush on him. I recognised that much at least, but I didn't think any harm could come from it and assumed that in time those feelings would pass and my attentions would shift towards girls. I thought I was just a slow developer. The notion that I could have what was then considered to be a mental disorder was one that would have horrified me. "The seat of government," said Father Squires, rubbing his hands together in glee, as we disembarked the bus on Kildare Street and made our way past the pair of guardies standing by the gates to the courtyard, who waved us in without even a word when they saw the collar around our principal's neck. "Think, lads, of all the great men who have passed through these doors. Eamon de Valera, Sean de Mas, Sean T. O'Kelly, the Countess Markovitch, who, strictly speaking, was not a man at all, but had the heart and guts of one. We'll not speak of Michael Collins and the blue shirts. If you see any of them renegades inside, look the other way as you would a Medusa. They're the sort of West Brit good-for-nothings that your daddy would have great time for. Am I right, Julian Woodbead?" All heads turned in Julian's direction, and he shrugged his shoulders. The Jesuits, of course, were ideologically opposed to Max Woodbead's veneration for the British Empire, and would have considered his love affair with Queen Elizabeth II to be heretical, although it didn't prevent them from taking his money. "Probably," said Julian, who believed that taking offence at anything a priest said was beneath his dignity. "We've had James Dillon over to the house a few times for dinner, if that's what you mean. Nice enough fellow, I suppose. Could do with a little advice on the personal hygiene front, of course." Father Squires shook his head in scorn and led the way through the doors, where we were met by an usher who bowed and scraped before the priest before giving us a tour of the ground floor of the house and leading us up a narrow staircase towards the visitors' gallery, where we took our seats in the colonnade. The chamber, that green horseshoe of independence that represented everything that the Irish people had fought for over the years, lay before us, and there was the Taoiseach, the great Eamon de Valera himself, who we scarcely believed existed outside of newspaper reports and our history lessons, holding forth on some topic to do with taxation and agriculture, and there wasn't a boy among our number who didn't feel they were in the presence of greatness. How often had we read about his role at Boland's Mill during the Easter Rising of 1916, or how he had raised millions of American dollars to assist in the establishment of an Irish Republic 3 years later? He was the stuff of legend. And there he was, in full sight of us, reading from a sheaf of papers in an uninterested voice, as if none of these grand events were anything to do with him at all. "Keep quiet now, lads," said Father Squires, his eyes growing moist with adoration.
Listen to the great man speak.
I did as I was told, but it wasn't long before I grew bored. He may well have been a great man, but he didn't seem to know when he'd made his point and should sit down again. Leaning over the railing, I glanced around at the half-empty seats of the chamber and counted how many of the Chakti-Dala were asleep. The number was 17. I searched for women TDs, but there were none to be found. Matthew Willoughby, who had won the history medal, had brought a notebook with him and was busy scribbling down every word that was said, and as time went on and Father Squires showed no sign of wanting to leave, my eyes started to close, and only when Julian tapped me on the arm and nodded towards the door behind us did I come back to life.
What?
I said, stifling a yawn.
Let's go outside and take a look around, he said.
We'll get in trouble.
And what if we do?
Does it matter?
I looked over towards Father Squires. He was seated in the front row, practically dribbling with Republican zeal. The chances of him noticing that we'd abandoned our posts were non-existent.
Let's go,
I said. We stood up and snuck out the same way that we'd come in, ignoring the ushers standing on duty at the doors of the gallery, lest they challenge us on our departure, and made our way down the staircase where another guard was sitting in an ornamental chair, the very replica of the one that had once sat on the ground floor of the house in Dartmouth Square, reading a newspaper.
Where do you lads think you're going?
He asked, looking as if he didn't particularly care about the answer but felt duty-bound to ask anyway.
Toilet,
said Julian, grabbing his crotch with one hand while doing a little dance on the spot as the man rolled his eyes.
Along down the corridor there,
he said, pointing the way as he dismissed us. We walked past him and past the toilets too, staring up at the oil portraits of the unknown dignitaries that glared down at us from the walls as if they knew that we were up to no good, and felt the excitement of being young, alive, and unsupervised by adults. I had no idea where we were going. Neither of us did. But it felt great to be on our own and having an adventure.
"Do you have any money on you, Cyril?"
Julian asked, after we had run out of corridors to investigate.
"Some," I said.
"Not much. Why?"
"There's a tea room over there.
We could get something to drink."
"Right enough," I said, and we made our way inside, holding our heads high as if we had every right to be there. It was a large room, about 30 feet wide and 4 times as long, and a woman was seated behind a desk on the nearest wall, a cash register next to her, watching people come to and fro as she counted her receipts. To my surprise, a pair of yellow phone boxes, the like of which I'd only ever seen on street corners, stood on either side of her desk. One was occupied by a TD, whose photograph I had seen in the papers, but the other was empty. The tables ran in 3 long rows, and despite the fact that there were plenty of empty seats, the men were gathered like moths around the few tables with a flame of seniority burned bright. I recognized a group of junior Fianna Fáil TDs sitting on the floor near a couple of ministers, waiting for a seat at the top table to open up and doing their best not to acknowledge the sheer indignity of their position. Naturally, Julian and I avoided the occupied tables and made our way to an empty one by a window, where we sat down with all the confidence of a couple of young dauphins until a young waitress, not much older than either of us, noticed us and came over. She was wearing a tight-fitting black-and-white uniform with the 2 top buttons of her blouse undone, and I could see Julian staring at her in hunger, his pupils dilating as he took her in. She was a looker. There was no denying it, with shoulder-length blonde hair and pale, clear skin.
"Let me wipe that clean for you," she said,
leaning over and running a damp dishcloth across the top of the table while she glanced from one of us to the other. I noticed her gaze settle on Julian, who was so much more handsome than me, and envied the ease with which she could take him in and appreciate his beauty. As she turned away to clear some napkins from the table's previous occupants, he sat up straight, craned his neck forward, and it was obvious that he was doing everything he could to look down her open blouse to capture every square inch of breast that was on display, to record it like a still photograph and develop it whenever he felt the urge.
"What can I get you?"
she asked finally, standing up again.
"2 pints of Guinness,"
said Julian. Casual as you like.
And you've any of that walnut cake that you had in here last Tuesday?
She stared at him with an expression that mingled amusement with attraction. He was only 14, but behaved in such an adult and confident fashion that I could tell that she didn't want to dismiss him out of hand.
"We're out of walnut cake," she said. "There was a run on it earlier. We have a bit of almond, though, if you'd like that."
"Oh, Christ, no," said Julian, shaking his head. "Almond gives me terrible gas.
I have a group of constituents coming in to see me later this afternoon, and the last thing I need is to be burping all over them. They'll never vote for me again, and that'll be me out of a job. I'll have to go back to teaching. What's your name anyway, sweetheart?"
he asked. And I looked down at my fingers, counting them one by one and wishing that she would just bring a pot of tea to the table and leave us in peace.
"I haven't seen you in here before, have I?"
"Bridges," said the waitress. "I'm new."
"How new?"
"This is my fourth day."
"The virgin waitress,"
said Julian, breaking into a broad grin, and I glanced across at him, scandalized by his choice of words. But Bridget seemed pleased with the flirtation and was ready to give back as good as she got.
"That's as much as you know," she said. "They say Elizabeth I was a virgin queen, but she was putting it about to every man left, right and centre. I saw a film about her with Betty Davis."
"I'm more of a Rita Hayworth than myself," he said. "Have you seen Gilda? Do you go to the pictures much?"
"I'm only saying," she said, ignoring his question. "Don't judge a book by its cover. Who are you anyway? Do you have a name?"
"Julian,"
said Julian.
"Julian Woodbead, TD for Dublin Central. When you've been here a few weeks, you'll get to know all our names. The other girls do."
She stared at him, and I could see that she was balancing in her mind the sheer impossibility of a boy's age being an elected representative, while, at the same time, considering how ludicrous it would be for him to be making such a story up. In the right light, he could have passed for older than 14. Not enough that any sensible person would believe he was a TD, but enough that a new girl in the tea room might be anxious enough about challenging him.
"Is that right?"
she said suspiciously.
"It is for the moment," he replied. "There'll be an election in a year or two, and I think my days might be numbered. The blue shirts are giving me an awful run for my money on the social welfare benefits. You're not a blue shirt, are you, Bridges?"
"I am not," she snapped. "Do you give me some credit? My family has always stood with Dev. My grandfather was in the GPO on Easter Sunday, and two of my uncles fought in the War of Independence."
"It must have been fierce busy in the GPO that day," I said, looking up and speaking for the first time. "There's barely a man, woman or child in Ireland who doesn't claim that their father or grandfather was at one of the windows standing his post. Must have been near impossible to buy a stamp."
"Who's this fella then?"
asked Bridget of Julian, looking at me as if I was something that had been dragged in by the cat on a cold winter's night.
"My sister's eldest lad," said Julian. "Don't mind him. Sure, he doesn't know what he's talking about. His hormones are all over the place at the moment.
Now, about those pints of Guinness, darling, is there any risk of getting them before I pass out with the thirst?"
She looked around as if uncertain what she should do.
"I don't know what Mrs. Goggin would say."
"And who's Mrs. Goggin?"
asked Julian.
"The manageress. My boss. She says I'm on trial for 6 weeks, and we'll see after that."
"She sounds like a difficult article."
"No, she's very nice, actually,"
said Bridget, shaking her head.
"She gave me a chance here when no one else would."
"Well, if she's all that nice, then I don't think she'd object to you taking an order for an elected TD from Dublin South, do you?"
"I thought you were Dublin Central."
"You're misremembering. I'm Dublin South."
"You're a bit of a laugh, but I don't believe a word you say."
"Ah, Bridget,"
said Julian, looking at her mournfully.
"Don't be like that. If you think I'm a laugh now, I promise you that I'm even more fun when I have a drink in me. 2 points of Guinness. That's all we want. Come on now. We've a thirst on us like Lawrence of Arabia."
She issued a deep sigh, as if she couldn't be bothered debating any more, before walking away and, to my astonishment, returning a few minutes later with 2 full dark pints of Guinness stout, which she placed before us, the yellow foam at the top spilling lazily over the head, leaving a snail's trail along the side of the glass.
"Enjoy them now,"
she said.
"Mr. T.D., for wherever you're from?"
"We will,"
said Julian. He lifted his pint and took a long gulp, and I watched his face grimace a little as he tried to swallow. His eyes closed briefly as he fought the urge to spit it back up.
"Christ, that tastes good,"
he said, with all the credibility of a Parisian complimenting a meal in central London.
"I needed that."
I took a sip from mine and, as it happens, didn't mind the taste at all. It was warmer than I'd expected and had a bitter flavour to it, but somehow it didn't make me gag. I gave it a sniff, then took another mouthful and breathed out through my nose. All good, I thought. I could get used to this.
"What do you think, Cyril?"
he asked me.
"Do I have a chance?"
"A chance at what?"
"A chance at Bridget."
"She's old," I said.
"Don't be ridiculous. She's only about 17. 3 years older than me. That's a great age for a girl."
I shook my head, feeling a rare irritation with him. "What do you know about girls, anyway?" I asked. "You're all talk."
"I know that if you say the right things to one, you can get her to do whatever you want."
"Like what?"
"Well, most of them won't let you go all the way, but they'll give you a blowy if you ask nicely."
I said nothing for a moment and considered this. I didn't want to display my ignorance before him, but was eager to know.
"What's a blowy?"
I asked.
"Oh, come on, Cyril! You're not that innocent."
"I'm joking," I said.
"No, you're not. You don't know."
"I do,"
I said. "Well, go on then. What is it?"
"It's when a girl kisses you," I said,
"and then she blows into your mouth."
He stared at me in bewilderment before starting to laugh.
"Why would any sane person do such a thing?" he asked me. "Unless you drowned, of course, and she was trying to bring you back to life."
"A blowy, Cyril, is where they put your thing in their mouth and give it an old sock."
My eyes opened wide, and I felt the familiar stirring in the crotch of my pants, attacking me faster than usual, my whole body alive with the idea of someone doing this to me. Or me doing it to someone else.
"That's not true,"
I said, blushing a little, for as exciting as it sounded, I found it hard to imagine that anyone would actually do such a bizarre thing.
"Of course it is," he said. "You're so naive, Cyril." "We'll have to knock that out of you one day. You need a woman. That's what you need."
I turned away, and my mind flitted to an image of Julian in our room every night, undressing for bed. The casual way he discarded his clothes, the complete lack of inhibition he showed as he stripped naked and slowly, casually, provocatively put on his pajamas while I pretended to read and tried not to make it obvious that I was watching from over the top of my book to capture another part of his body in my memory. A vision of him coming over to my bed to give me a blowy filled my mind, and I struggled not to whimper in longing.
"Excuse me,"
said a voice from halfway down the tea room, and I turned to see a woman of about 30 marching towards us. Her hair was tied up on her head, and she was wearing a different uniform to the one that the waitresses wore, a more professional outfit. I glanced at the metal badge pinned above her right breast that bore the words, "Catherine Goggin, manageress."
"Are those pints of Guinness that you boys are drinking?"
"They are,"
said Julian, barely looking up at her. His interest in girls did not extend this far up the age ladder. She might have been his great-grandmother for all the interest he had in her.
"And how old are you both?"
"Sorry," said Julian, standing and picking up his jacket from behind the chair.
"No time to chat. I have a meeting of the parliamentary party to attend. Be right there, Cyril."
I stood up too, but the woman pressed a hand firmly down on both our shoulders, pushing us back into our seats.
"Who served you these drinks?" "She are only children."
"I'll have you know that I am the TD for Wicklow,"
said Julian, who seemed to be working his way slowly down the east coast of the country.
"And I'm Eleanor Roosevelt,"
said the woman.
"So why does your name badge say Catherine Goggin?"
asked Julian.
"You're with the school party that came in this morning, aren't you?" she asked, ignoring his question. "Where's your teacher? You shouldn't be wandering the corridors of Dáil Éireann alone, let alone drinking alcohol."
Before we could answer, I saw Bridget running over to our table, her face red and flustered, and behind her, in hot pursuit, was the irate face of Father Squires, followed by our four award-winning classmates.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Goggin," said Bridget quickly. "He said he was a TD."
"And how could you possibly believe that?" asked Mrs. Goggin.
"Sure, would you take a look at them? Aren't they only children? Do you have no more sense than a sweeping brush? I'm away on my holidays to Amsterdam next week, Bridget. Do I have to spend all my time there worrying that you're serving alcohol to minors?"
"Get up, the pair of you," said Father Squires, pushing his way between the two women. "Get up and shame me no more.
We'll have a conversation about this when we're back at Belvedere, so we will."
We stood up again, both a little embarrassed by how things had turned out, and the manageress turned on the priest furiously.
"Don't be blaming them," she said. "Sure, aren't they just causing trouble the way any kids will? You're the one who's supposed to be looking after them, letting them loose in Leinster House," she added, shaking her head in disgust, "where the business of the nation is conducted.
I don't think their parents would be too happy to know they were down here supping pints of Guinness when they should have been learning, do you?
Well, Father, do you?"
Father Squires stared at her in utter astonishment, as did we all. It's unlikely that anyone had ever spoken to him like this since the moment the collar first went around his neck. And for his accuser to be a woman was the worst insult of all. I could hear Julian chuckling beside me, and knew that he was impressed by her audacity. I was impressed myself.
"You'll keep a civil tongue in your head, missy," said Father Squires, poking a finger into her left shoulder. "You're addressing a man of the cloth, you know, not one of your boyfriends from Kyo's public house."
"My boyfriends, if I had any, would surely have more sense than to let underage boys wander the corridors unsupervised," she said, refusing to be intimidated by him. "And I won't be poked and prodded by priests. Do you hear me? Those days are long behind me, so take care not to touch me again. Now, this is my tea room, Father. I'm in charge of it, and you're to take this pair out of here right now and leave the rest of us to get on with our work."
Father Squires, looking as if he was about to have a series of heart attacks, a nervous breakdown and a stroke all at the same time, turned on his heel and marched away in full dudgeon. He could barely speak, the poor man, and I don't think he did until we were safely back on the grounds of Belvedere College, when, of course, he let rip at me and Julian. As I stood to leave the tea-room, however, I glanced back at Catherine Goggin and couldn't help but smile at her. I had never seen anyone put a priest in his place in the way that she had just done, and thought the whole thing had been better than the pictures. "Whatever punishment is coming my way," I told her, "it was worth it just to see that." She stared at me for a moment before bursting out laughing.
"Go along now, you little demon," she said, reaching forward and ruffling my hair.
"You're in there,"
whispered Julian in my ear as we left the tea-room. "And there's nothing better than an old one for teaching a young dog a few tricks." Max's right ear. In the early autumn of 1959, Max Woodbead wrote an article in the Irish Times condemning Eamon de Valera, a man he despised, and his government for relaxing its policy on the internment without trial of suspected IRA members. "End their imprisonment by all means," he wrote, his words appearing next to a particularly obnoxious photograph of him sitting in the garden of what had once been my home, wearing a three-piece suit, a luxurious white rose spilling out from his buttonhole, while he studied a plate of cucumber sandwiches that lay before him. "But rather than letting an assortment of misguided patriots and uneducated thugs roam the streets to cause carnage with their guns and bombs, it might be more beneficial to simply line them up against a wall and shoot them, just as our erstwhile overseers did to the leaders of the Easter Rising when they dared to challenge the divine authority of His Imperial Majesty King George V.
The piece received extensive coverage across the media, and as levels of outrage increased, he was invited onto Radio Erin to defend his position. Butting heads with a rabidly Republican interviewer, he claimed that it had been a dark day for Ireland when the country had severed its ties with England. The brightest minds in Dáil Éireann, he claimed, would never be as sharp as the dimmest eggheads in Westminster. Those who were taking part in the border campaign he condemned as cowards and murderers and, in one of his more self-satisfied moments, and one that he had surely rehearsed in advance to ensure maximum provocation, suggested that a sustained Luftwaffe-style blitzkrieg at the border along the counties of Armagh, Tyrone and Fermanagh would put an end to the terrorist activities of the Irish people once and for all. Asked why he possessed such fervently pro-English views when he had been born in Rat Mines, he almost burst into song as he pointed out that his family had been one of the most prominent in Oxford for centuries. He seemed truly proud to admit that two of his ancestors had been beheaded by Henry VIII for opposing the king's marriage to Anne Boleyn, and that another had been burned at the stake by Queen Mary herself, unlikely, for tearing down signs of Roman idolatry at Oxford Cathedral.
"I was the first of my family to be born in Ireland," he said, "and this was only because my father moved here to practice law after the end of the Great War. And as the Duke of Wellington, who, I think we would all agree, was a magnificent man, said, just because a man is born in a stable, this does not make him a horse."
"Maybe not a horse, but an ass for certain," declared Father Squires the following day in class, haranguing Julian for Max's treasonous sentiments. "Which makes you a henny or a mule?"
"I've been called worse," said Julian,
not looking in the least affronted.
"The thing is, there's no point trying to equate my father's political opinions with my own. He has so many, you see, while I have absolutely none."
"That's because your head is empty."
"Oh,
I don't know,"
he muttered under his breath.
"There's a few idle thoughts in there somewhere."
"Would you, as a proud Irishman, at least condemn him for the things he said?"
"No,"
replied Julian. "I don't even know what you're so incensed over. I never read the papers, and they don't own a radio, so I've no idea what he said to cause all this fuss. Was it something to do with ladies being allowed to swim at the 40-foot? He does grow enraged whenever that subject comes up."
"Ladies being—"
Father Squire stared at him in disbelief, and I wondered how long it would be before his stick appeared to make mincemeat of my friend.
"This has nothing to do with ladies being allowed to swim at the 40-foot," he roared. "Although it'll be a cold day in hell when that is allowed to happen. That's nothing more than a bunch of shameless hussies getting their kicks by parading around half-naked."
"Sounds all right to me," said Julian with a half-smile.
"Have you not been listening to a word I've been saying? Your father is a traitor to his own people. Do you feel no shame for that, no?"
"No, I don't. Isn't there something in the Bible about sons not being put to death for the sins of their fathers?"
"Don't quote the Bible at me, you bloody Westbrit brat,"
said Father Squires, storming down to our table and standing over us so I could smell the sweat that followed him around like a guilty secret.
"And what it says is that they shall both be put to death for their own sins."
"That sounds a bit harsh. And I didn't quote it anyway. I paraphrased it, and obviously got it hopelessly wrong too."
This was the type of back and forth which seemed to annoy most of our classmates, turning Julian into a rather unpopular figure, but the way he challenged Father Squires delighted me. He was arrogant, certainly, and had no respect for authority, but he made his pronouncements with such insouciance that I found it impossible not to be charmed by him. So vocal was Max, however, on his condemnation of the IRA that perhaps no one should have been too surprised when, a few weeks later, while leaving Dartmouth Square one morning for an appointment at the forecourts, an attempt was made on his life. A gunman, hiding in the centre of the gardens, Maud would not have been happy, fired two bullets in his direction, one lodging in the woodwork of the front door, the other skimming past the right side of his head, tearing his ear off, and coming perilously close to what I suppose would be considered his brain. Max ran back inside screaming, blood pouring down the side of his face, and barricaded himself in his study until the Gardaí and the ambulance arrived. At the hospital, it became quite clear that no one had any sympathy for him whatsoever, and even less interest in tracking down his intended assassin, and so, when he was released, half-deaf and with an inflamed red scar where his right ear used to be, he hired a bodyguard, a burly man with the look of a more muscular Charles Lawton, and who went by the name of Rory O'Shaughnessy, a surprisingly Gaelic title for one in whose hands Max was placing his life. Wherever Julian's father went, O'Shaughnessy went too, and they became quite a familiar pair around Inns Quay. Unbeknownst to any of us, however, was that, having failed to kill him for his verbal insults, the IRA had decided to try something a little more imaginative next time to punish him. A far more daring project was in the works, where Max was not the target at all. Borstal Boy. Having enjoyed our brief escape from the clutches of Belvedere College during Julian's short-lived career as a TD, we decided to try our luck on the outside more often. Soon, we were visiting city centre cinemas for afternoon matinees, or strolling through the grounds of Trinity College to gawp at the Protestants, who seemed to have been dehorned by some benevolent shearer upon admission. We were drawn to the record and clothes shops along Henry Street, despite the fact that we could afford very little, and when Julian stole a copy of Frank Sinatra's Songs for Swinging Lovers from a market stall, we ran all the way back to school, delirious with the exhilaration of youth. A few weeks after our visit to the Doll, we were walking along O'Connell Street one afternoon, having fled Parnell Square after a particularly tedious geography class, and I felt a spontaneous burst of joy that I had never quite known before. The sun was out, Julian was wearing a short-sleeved shirt that accentuated his biceps, and my pubic hair had finally kicked in. Our friendship had never been closer, and hours stretched before us where we could talk and exchange confidences, excluding anyone and anything from our tiny universe that didn't interest us. For once, the world seemed to be a place filled with possibilities. "What shall we do today?" I asked, pausing by Nelson's pillar and using the shade from the pedestal to keep the sun from my eyes. "Well, actually, hold on," said Julian, stopping abruptly by a staircase that led beneath the street to a public urinal. 2 minutes, call of nature." I waited where I was, kicking my heels against the base of the statue and looking around. To my right, I could see the General Post Office, where Max Woodbead's nemesis, the leaders of the 1916 Rising, had exhorted Irish men and Irish women in the name of God and of the dead generations to answer a summons to the flag and strike for their freedom.
"You're a good-looking lad,"
growled a voice from behind me, and I turned to see Julian grinning madly and starting to laugh when he saw the expression on my face. "I was down in the jacks," he said, nodding back towards the pillar. "And this man comes up to me while I'm taking a piss and says that to me." "Oh," I said.
"I forgot that's where all the queers hang out," he said, shuddering. "In underground laboratories waiting for innocent young boys like me to come along."
"You're hardly an innocent young boy," I said, glancing back towards the staircase, wondering who or what might ascend from there to drag Julian or me down into that dark underworld.
"No, but that's what they look for. Guess what I did?"
"What?" I asked.
"I turned around and pissed all over his trousers. He got a good look at my thing, but it was worth it. It'll be hours before his pants are dry enough for him to come back up. You should have heard the names he called me. Imagine Cyril, a dirty queer, calling me names."
"You should have hit him," I said.
"No need for that," he replied, frowning. "Violence never solved anything."
I said nothing. Whenever I tried to agree with him on subjects of this nature, he always seemed to backtrack on me, leaving me baffled as to how I had got things so wrong.
"So," I said, and we walked on, keen to put as much distance between us and the public toilet as possible while trying not to think about how awful it must be
to have to go to such places to find anything approaching affection.
What should we do today?
Let's have a think, he said cheerfully.
Any suggestions?
We could go take a look at the docks and St. Stephen's Green, I suggested. If we picked up a loaf of bread, we could feed it to them.
Julian laughed and shook his head.
We won't be doing that, he said.
Well, what if we walk down towards the Hapney Bridge?
They say that if you jump up and down on it, it starts to rock. We could frighten the life out of the old women as they're crossing it.
No, said Julian. Not that either.
Well, what then? I said. You suggest something.
Did you ever hear of the Palace Bar?
He asked. And I knew at once that he'd already planned our afternoon for us and I would have no choice but to fall in line.
No, I said.
It's off Westmoreland Street. All the students from Trinity College go there, and the old fellas because they serve the best porter. Let's go there.
A pub? I said dubiously.
Yes, Cyril, a pub, he replied, brushing his hair back from his forehead and grinning.
We want an adventure, don't we?
And you never know who we might run into. How much money have you got in you?
I fished around in my pockets and pulled out my change.
Although I almost never saw him, Charles was fairly generous in my allowance. 50 pence arriving in my school bank account every Monday morning without fail. A real Avery, of course, would probably have got a pound.
Not bad, said Julian, totting it up in his head. I've got about the same. We've the makings of a good afternoon there if we use it sensibly.
They won't serve us, I said.
Of course they will.
We look old enough. Well, I do, anyway.
And we have money, which is all that these places really care about.
We'd be fine.
Can we go see the ducks first? I asked.
No, Cyril, he said, torn between frustration and amusement.
Fuck the ducks.
We're going to the pub.
I said nothing. It was rare that the F-word was employed by any of us, and when it was, it signalled absolute authority.
There was simply no going against the F-word. Just before we entered the pub, Julian stopped outside a pharmacy and dug around in his pockets, pulling out a piece of paper.
Give me 2 minutes, he said. I have to pick something up.
What?
I asked.
A prescription. A prescription for what?
Are you sick?
No, I'm grand. I had to see a doctor the other day, that's all. It's nothing serious.
I frowned and watched him as he walked inside, and a moment later followed him in.
I told you to wait outside, he said when he saw me.
No, you didn't. What's wrong with you anyway?
He rolled his eyes.
It's nothing, he said. Just a rash.
What sort of a rash?
Where is it?
Never you mind where it is.
The pharmacist appeared from the dispensary behind him and handed something across.
Use it lavishly on the affected area twice a day, he said,
taking Julian's money.
Will it sting? Not as much as it will if you don't use it.
Thank you, said Julian, putting the packet in his pocket, handing across the money and marching off, leaving me to follow in his wake.
Julian, I said when we were back in the street.
What was all that?
Cyril,
he said. It's none of your business, all right? Just leave it.
Come on. Here's the pub.
I said nothing more, not wanting to incur his wrath. But I was hurt and disappointed that he wouldn't let me into his secret. There were 2 doors at the entrance, set out into the street like 2 sides of an equilateral triangle, and Julian chose the left-hand one, holding it open just long enough for me to follow him inside. A narrow corridor faced a long and colourful bar where a 6 men were seated at stools, smoking and staring at their pints of Guinness, as if within that dark liquid the meaning of life could be discovered. Past the bar were a couple of empty tables, and beyond them, a snug. The barman, a tetchy-looking character with pumpkin orange hair and eyebrows to match, slung a towel over his shoulder and eyed us warily as we made our way towards the nearest table.
"The snug is for women and kids," whispered Julian to me, "or for men hiding on their wives. We'll stay out here."
"I've a terrible thirst on me,"
he roared, making me jump as every head in the place turned in our direction.
But after a long day's work at the docks, there's nothing I enjoy more than a pint. You're the same, aren't you, Cyril? Landlord, will you bring a couple of pints of the black stuff over here?
He shouted, smiling at the ginger behind the counter.